continuing our study in the book of Acts. And as Larry pointed out last week, it's kind of downhill from here. Most of what we'll be covering from here on out is Paul's detention in Jerusalem. Paul's trip to Caesarea Maritima, and then his final trip to Rome. So we'll be doing pretty much reading. We'll probably make it through the 22nd and 23rd chapters today, just reading through Paul's encounter with what happens in Jerusalem, and then what happens once he is transported up to Caesarea Maritima. Let me get my Bible open. There we go. So, starting in Acts 22 and verse 1, Paul says, Paul is at the end of chapter 21, where Larry left you in a cliffhanger last week. Paul was surrounded by, taken prisoner by, or was the Jews were attempting or wanting to kill Paul, and a Roman cohort came in and saved Paul, and they were going to take Paul away, and Paul asked to be heard. So I'm going to just back up a little bit and read the last few verses of chapter 21. So, starting in Acts 21 and 37, just as a recap, as Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the commander, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek? Then you are not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness." But Paul said, "I am a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city. And I beg you, allow me to speak to the people." When he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the stairs, motioned to the people with his hand. And when there was a great hush, he spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect, saying, that was our cliffhanger, and we'll start in verse 22 now. "Brethren and fathers, hear my defense, which I now offer to you." And when they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew dialect, they became even more quiet. And he said, "I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city, educated under Gamaliel, strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you all are today. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and putting both men and women into prison. As also the high priest and all the council of the elders can testify, from them I also received letters to the brethren and started off for Damascus in order to bring even those who were there to Jerusalem as prisoners to be punished. But it happened that as I was on my way approaching Damascus, about noontime, a very bright light suddenly flashed from heaven all around me, and I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, 'Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?' And I answered, 'Who are you, Lord?' And he said to me, 'I am Jesus, the Nazarene, whom you are persecuting. And those who were with me saw the light, to be sure, but did not understand the voice of the one who was speaking to me. And I said, What shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said to me, Get up and go into Damascus, and there you will be told of all that has been appointed for you to do. But since I could not see Because of the brightness of that light, I was led by the hand by those who were with me and came into Damascus. So Paul is recounting so far what happened to him. This is the second time that Paul has done this, and he will recount it yet again when he is before the governors in Caesarea Maritima. And continuing in verse 12, a certain Ananias, a man who was devout by the standard of the law, and well spoken of by all the Jews who lived there, came to me, and standing near said to me, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And at that very time I looked up at him. And he said, The God of our fathers has appointed you to know his will, and to see the righteous one, and to hear an utterance from his mouth. For you will be a witness for him to all men of what you have seen and heard. Now why do you delay? Get up and be baptized, and wash away your sins, calling on his name. It happened when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple that I fell into a trance. And I saw him saying to me, Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me. And I said, Lord, they themselves understand that in one synagogue after another I used to imprison and beat those who believed in you. And when the blood of your witness Stephen was being shed, I also was standing by approving and watching out for the coats of those who were slaying him. That's, again, a recounting of Acts chapter 8, when Stephen was slain, and where we're introduced to Paul, who is Saul at the time, standing there holding the coats and approving of Stephen's stoning. Continuing in verse 20. And when the blood of your witness Stephen was being shed, I was also standing by approving and watching out for the coats of those who were slaying him. And he said to me, Go, for I will send you a far way to the Gentiles. They listened to him up to this statement, and then they raised their voices and said, Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live. And as they were crying out, and throwing off their cloaks, and tossing dust into the air, the commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks, stating that he should be examined by scourging, so that he might find out the reason why they were shouting against him that way. But when they stretched him out with thongs, Paul said to the centurion, who was standing by, Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? We've discussed this before several times as Paul has been about his missionary journeys. What did the Roman jailer do to himself, or try to do to himself, when the angel let all the prisoners or opened all the jail cells? He was going to thrust himself through with the sword, right? Why?
Because they had a thing that if they lost a prisoner, they would suffer to death.
They would either have the death penalty, or they would take the place of the prisoner in whatever they were going to have done to them. So if you were a Roman jailer, then you lost somebody who was facing the death penalty of whatever that was, somebody who was about to be crucified, guess what was going to happen to you? So, this Roman commander here has ordered Paul to be scourged. And what Paul is telling the centurion is, I haven't even been heard. I have not been legally found guilty of anything. I am a Roman citizen, and you're about to scourge me. What is the centurion facing if he does this? The exact same thing he's doing. Disciplining a Roman citizen without due process was grounds for receiving the same penalty. So So this centurion, when he finds out Paul's a Roman citizen, says, whoa, hold your horses. We're going to stop right here. And so we're going to see. But when they stretched him out with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? He had not had due process. When the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and told him, saying, what are you about to do? This man is a Roman. The commander came to him and said to him, tell me, are you a Roman? And Paul said, yes. The commander answered, I acquired this citizenship with a large sum of money. And Paul said, but I was actually born a citizen. So we had had, I've asked this question several times, how did Romans prove that they were Romans? We don't know. It's not like they had a Social Security database, you know. So it looks like you had to have proof that you were born a Roman citizen. If you were to lie about that, it sounds like it would be treacherous if that lie was brought out. Paul is saying he was born a Roman. He could point to his father, who was a Roman, or mother, or we don't know a whole lot about Paul. This commander gives us another insight into how you could become a Roman citizen. You didn't have to be born that way. This man could have been an African. He could have been an Egyptian. But what did he do? He bought his citizenship. He paid to be a Roman citizen. So we see that being part of the Roman Empire was either something you were born into or something you bought into. And Rome was more than happy to take your money and make you a citizen. As we can see from a Roman commander, this isn't just the centurion. This is the commander over the centurion. This is a legionnaire, probably. So he's a commander of thousands of men. And he bought his way into the Roman citizenship. So with a tiny sum of money, he says. Continuing in verse 29, therefore those who were about to examine him immediately let go of him. And the commander also was afraid when he found out that he was a Roman, and because he had put him in chains. Even this man, who was head over all of these Roman soldiers, was afraid just because he had put Paul in chains without due process. He had bound him in front of the Jews, in front of all these people, and had not even asked the question, are you a Roman? So Paul, again, here, is in the cat seat, as you would say. He's just as he was when he was beaten and scourged on one of his missionary journeys, and then the head of the city, the magistrates of the city came by after finding out that he was a Roman who had been beaten without due process, and they just tried to flee him out of the town. Leave, please, please go. Because they knew what they were facing. They were facing severe punishment for scourging or beating a Roman citizen without due process. And again, Paul here knows, being a Roman, that being bound in chains, being scourged, being mistreated in any way without due process was grounds for severe punishment under Roman law. So Paul is in a better place here now because he knows where he stands. He knows that he has the protection of this Roman guard because they're not going to let anything happen to him now. They've mistreated him in a way that puts them in a bad way. In front of witnesses, they've done this. And so they're going to do their best to make sure that Paul stays alive. So Paul knows that he's got protection now, and nothing's going to happen to him. In verse 30, but on the next day, Wishing to know for certain why he had been accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priests and all the council to assemble, and brought Paul down and set him before them. Next chapter, 23. Paul, looking intently at the council, said, "Brethren, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day. The high priest Ananias commanded those standing beside him to strike him on the mouth." Now, Ananias is not a Roman. He's a Jew. And, as well, Paul is a Jew. So, Ananias isn't worried about this Roman law, because Ananias probably isn't a Roman. He's a Jew. He probably doesn't have the dual citizenship that Paul does. So he's not worried about any consequences from this. And he feels that he's in the right. Paul is talking back to the high priest, which is a no-no in Jewish law. The high priest was the high priest. He was the leader of the people. And therefore felt he had the authority to command Paul. In verse 3, then Paul said to him, "God is going to strike you, whitewashed wall. Do you sit to try me according to the law, and in violation of the law, order me to be struck?" So Paul's pointing out to Ananias, again, that it's against God's law for somebody to be struck, or to be hit, or to be punished without due process. Paul had done nothing to deserve being hit. And the bystander said, "Do you revile God's high priest?" Paul, responding, said, "I was not aware, brethren, that he was high priest. For it is written, 'You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.' But perceiving that one group were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, 'Brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead.'" What would this cause in a council full of Pharisees and Sadducees? This one statement Paul had made. And why would it cause this issue? Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection. We're told Sadducees didn't believe in angels. Sadducees didn't believe in afterlife in any way. Sadducees were sad. The Pharisees did. They believed in all of these things. As the New Testament tells us, they believed in all of these things. So, we see Paul again using his knowledge that he had gained through life as a Pharisee, educated at the feet of Gamaliel, a very well-known and well-respected Pharisee. Paul used that knowledge to again defend himself, because all Paul had to say was this one phrase: "I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead." And what happened in the council chamber? Chaos. Absolute chaos. It erupted in argument. As he said this, there occurred a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. Are they going to find Paul guilty? Are these Pharisees going to side with the Sadducees when Paul is saying that he's being persecuted because he believes in the afterlife? Because he believes in resurrection. Are these Pharisees going to now side with the Sadducees over this? No. Not at all. I suppose that if it was Jesus standing before them, they hated him so much, they would probably do that. But, and they did, because they came together in their hatred and killed Jesus. But Paul had earned the respect of many of the Pharisees that were here. Now, I'm sure that they felt betrayed by Paul because he stopped persecuting Christians and was actually preaching the way. And that probably irked them. But they also knew that Paul was well-trained, that Paul was well-educated, and that Paul knew what he was talking about. And the last thing they're going to do is side with the Sadducees, who I wouldn't call them mortal enemies, but they didn't get along at all. And the last thing they're going to do is side with those Sadducees in this particular instance. And that's what we see happens here. In verse 8, for the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. So Paul has basically started a riot with one phrase. Just a heated argument between these two parts of the council, and nothing's going to get done. They cannot stop arguing about this long enough to find that Paul has done anything illegal, which he hasn't. They have tried to accuse him of bringing a Gentile into the temple, which he didn't do. But besides that, there's nothing for them to find him guilty of. In verse 9, and there occurred a great uproar, and some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, we find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit or angel has spoken to him. Not only are they not against Paul, they're now defending Paul. They're saying, well, how can you say that he doesn't know what he's talking about, or how can you say he's lying? Maybe he heard a spirit. Maybe an angel gave him this information. What kind of response would that get from the Sadducees? If this was a heated uproar on the Pharisaical side, them defending Paul based on an angel or a spirit giving him information would cause the Sadducees to do what? Respond in kind. They're going to be just as angry, and the uproar is going to get even larger because the Pharisees are now defending Paul because of one phrase that he made. That he is on trial because of the resurrection of the dead. In verse 10, as a great dissension was developing, the commander, now remember, the Roman cohort has guided Paul in here and set him down. They didn't just walk out. They're there. They're defending Paul because remember, they're on the line too. They brought Paul into the lion's den. And they were getting ready to kill Paul just the day before. And so this Roman cohort is not going to allow Paul to be hurt in any way. So we see that as the great dissension was developing, the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. But on the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his side and said, take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness also, or at Rome also. So the Romans take Paul. He goes right back into the barracks where the Jews have no chance of getting a hold of him, where he will be fully protected. And you can imagine that this row that was going on in the council probably continued for some time. These people probably didn't even notice that Paul had left because their argument against each other was so heated. And the Sadducees wanted to kill Paul. The Pharisees, defending Paul, who also wanted to find him guilty but were defending him based on their beliefs, they wanted nothing to do with the Sadducees. They wanted to protect Paul only to the point that they thought that they were right, that they were standing in the right. So in verse 12, when it was day, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who formed this plot. And they came to the chief priests and the elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a solemn oath to taste nothing until we have killed Paul." Now, what should be the chief priest's response to something like this? Do you think that they should be telling the Jews, "No, no, no"? Do you think that they should be doing something to protect a fellow Jew? But the chief priest, who had ordered Paul hit in the mouth, does nothing to stop this. In verse 15, "Now therefore you and the council notify the commander to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case by a more thorough investigation, and we for our part are ready to slay him before he comes near the place." So the high priest now, the chief priest, are in collusion with people who are doing something against Jewish law, against Roman law, something that will most likely incite a riot, which will bring the Romans down on them. And the chief priests are going along with this. They are colluding with this thing that they know is wrong, just the same way they had colluded with each other to kill Jesus. But they can wash their hands of this one and say, "We had nothing to do with it. It was these guys over here trying to just walk away from the situation, just letting it happen." So the chief priest, though, now in possession of the knowledge that these men want to kill Paul, and that they're willing to go to great lengths to kill Paul, are saying nothing about it. We got 40 men here who are Jews, and a Roman cohort who's going to be bringing Paul back to the council chamber, if that were to happen. Do you think that the Jews would be indiscriminate about who they kill? These 40 men who are going to descend on these Romans, you think that no one else is going to get hurt? What do you think would happen if these guys were successful? Or if they killed Romans during this attack? As I think we've seen in the past, when Roman soldiers are threatened or killed by the people that they've dominated, what usually happens? Rome usually descends on them and have no mercy on what they do. These chief priests have no idea what kind of trouble they are inviting by allowing these men to do what they're about to do. Because chances are, Roman soldiers are going to get hurt or killed in this ambush attack. And that's going to hurt everybody in Jerusalem, because if a Roman cohort, if a group of soldiers gets killed or hurt, you're going to have a lot more than a group of soldiers descending on Jerusalem. You're going to have an army of Romans flooding into Jerusalem. In verse 16, "But the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, and he came and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, 'Lead this young man to the commander, for he has something to report to him.' So he took him and led him to the commander and said, 'Paul the prisoner called me to him and asked me to lead this young man to you, since he has something to tell you.' The commander took him by the hand and, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately, 'What is it you have to report to me?' And he said, 'The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the council, as though they were going to inquire somewhat more thoroughly about him. So do not listen to them, for more than 40 of them are lying in wait for him, who have bound themselves under a curse not to eat or drink until they slay him. And now they are ready and waiting for the promise from you.'" So, disaster averted. Paul's nephew saves most likely his life if he had gone this way, or the lives of these 40 Jews who would probably get slaughtered by the Roman soldiers. And if Roman soldiers got killed, you can imagine that it would expand a lot further than just the 40 men who were attacking. They would probably indiscriminately kill anybody who was around who got caught up in this attack. So this nephew of Paul has saved a lot of lives here by taking it upon himself to go see Paul and say, they're going to try and get you. They're coming after you. They've got a plan, and they are going to execute it if you go down there. And this commander, who has, again, if this is the same commander, and I assume it is, purchased his Roman citizenship, sees nothing but trouble happening here. I mean, he thinks he's the unluckiest man around. He's beaten a Roman citizen without cause, and now he's got an uproar, 2 days of potential riots that are starting to happen here in Jerusalem over this one man. And now he sees that he's got an ambush waiting for his soldiers. What is his response to this? I mean, is he going to face down this hornet's nest? What would you do? I'd dodge. I'd run as fast in the opposite direction as I possibly could. And that's what he does. So, in verse 22 of chapter 23, so the commander let the young man go, instructing him, tell no one what you have notified me of these things. And then, starting in verse 23, and he called to him two of the centurions and said, get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night to proceed to Caesarea with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. Okay? He is not taking any risks this time. They're going to go 40 miles north. I think that's about the distance to Caesarea Maritima. 40 miles north with horsemen and spearmen to guard this one man who is a Roman citizen. Bob.
Are you supposed that they would do that for any other ordinary Roman citizen?
Well, one that they beat illegally, probably. but I couldn't say. But what I can say is that he has put himself in a position where he doesn't have a choice now. He's got to do everything he can to protect this man because he's bound him in chains. He's commanded him to be scourged, and all without due process because he's a Roman citizen. So you can see how seriously he, this commander, who bought his citizenship, thinks it is, how important he thinks it is to keep Paul alive.
Just to digress a little, you know, Paul was followed by the Jews from city to city.
Right.
I mean, if you start off with this much intensity, it didn't back down.
No.
At all. It was always this way.
Correct. On each of his missionary journeys, he had Jews that would follow when they heard that he had left the city and gone to another and was preaching. They would leave there, follow Paul, just to do the same thing they did in their city, which was to make him go away. They wanted to do anything they could to make his life as hard as possible. And when Paul recounts the things that he had been through in 2 Corinthians, tells us all the things he had to go through, beatings and scourgings and starving and all the things that he went through, we can imagine that with the response that he gets from many of the Mosaic Jews or the Judaizing Christians, we can understand that Paul would have to face this on a regular basis, regardless of the fact that he was a Roman citizen. They didn't care about that. They also knew he was a Jew and that he was preaching, he was not preaching Mosaic law. He was preaching a new way, this following this Jesus of Nazareth. And they were willing to do just about anything, including killing Paul, to make him stop. In verse 24, they were also to provide mounts to put Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor. That being said, how often does a Roman citizen who's being guarded by 200 spearmen and 70 horsemen get put on his own horse? and not forced to walk the distance. But that just tells you how fast they want to get there. They are planning to move very quickly to Caesarea Maritima. And he wrote a letter having this form. This is the commander who wrote a letter having this form. Claudius Lysias to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came up to them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. That's how it went, right? Yeah, do you think he's covering himself? And wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council and found him to be accused over questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment, except the fact that I bound him in chains and was going to have him scourged. Right? I don't see that in there, though. Verse 30, when I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you. And so at least one part of that letter is probably true. I'm giving the problem to you, Felix, and the Jews will be up there sometime soon. So get ready. Verse 31, so the soldiers, in accordance with their orders, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. But the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they returned to the barracks. When these had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. And when he had read it, he asked from what province he was. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive, also giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's Praetorium. So Larry's gone over this several times, and he's got a lot better pictures. This is just an artist's conception of the Praetorium. You can see that this would be an awesome place to live. Herod spared no expense building this beautiful, wonderful, elaborate home on the coast. And as I recall from Larry's historic recount of this area, this Praetorium, baths all over the place. I mean, you're right next to the ocean, but you have your own private baths inside the Praetorium. I mean, just a beautiful place. So Paul, being this Roman citizen, coming to this governor, Felix, is being held here, and he's going to spend quite a bit of time here in Caesarea Maritima. Does anybody recall how much time he spends here? Yeah, almost 2 years, okay? So he's going to spend 2 years on the coast. That's just horrible, right? And here in Praetorium, nonetheless, I mean, I doubt he's in chains right now because he's been found guilty of nothing. So he's a guest of the Romans in Caesarea Maritima for 2 years. So we can imagine that Paul probably had the opportunity here to run into, who did he run in when he was headed down to Jerusalem? Now, who, when he was coming back down the coast, Paul ran into Philip, who had converted the Ethiopian eunuch, and then had been whisked away and wound up in Caesarea Maritima. And with Philip here in this town, Paul's going to be here 2 years. You can imagine that Paul probably got to converse with Philip. But he's not being held prisoner here. He's just being held. He's going to be basically judged by Felix, and then we'll see in the next couple of chapters by Festus, and then King Agrippa. I mean, but none of them want to do anything to him. They can't find that he's done anything wrong. That's what we're going to be reading in the next few chapters. We probably won't get there today, but Paul's going to spend a considerable amount of time in this place, waiting to be judged. So in chapter 24, we'll just get started into it. We only have about 5 minutes left here. Chapter 24 and verse 1, after 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders, with an attorney named Tertullus, and they brought charges to the governor against Paul. After Paul had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying to the governor, "Since we have through you attained much peace, and since by your providence reforms are being carried out for this nation, we acknowledge this in every way and everywhere, most excellent Felix, with all thankfulness. But that I may not weary you in any further, I beg you to grant us, by your kindness, a brief hearing." Does this sound like a lawyer or what? Verse 5, "For we have found this man a real test, and a fellow who stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes." A ringleader. "And he even tried to desecrate the temple." This is what they're accusing him of. "And then we arrested him. We wanted to judge him according to our law, but Lysias the commander came along, and with much violence took him out of our hands." What did Lysias prevent Paul them from doing to Paul? Killing him. They wanted to kill him because they're accusing him of doing something that he didn't even do. That is bringing a Gentile into the temple. "And with much violence took him out of our hands, ordering his accusers to come before you. By examining him yourself concerning all these matters, you will be able to ascertain the things of which we accuse him. The Jews also joined in the attack, asserting that these things were so." When the governor had nodded for him to speak, Paul responded, "Knowing that for many years you have been a judge to this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. Since you can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago, I went up to Jerusalem to worship. Neither in the temple, nor in the synagogue, nor in the city itself, did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or causing a riot. Nor can they prove to you the charges which they now accuse me. But this I admit to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men cherish themselves, that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked." We're hoping there's no Sadducees there, right? "In view of this, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience both before God and before men. Now, after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings, in which they found me occupied in the temple, having been purified without crowd or uproar. But there were some Jews from Asia who ought to have been present before you and to make accusation if they should have anything against me." This goes back to what Carol was just saying. Who was causing the uproar? These Jews from Asia that had been chasing Paul all around the globe, going from city to city, accusing him of things that he didn't do. Verse 20, "Or else let these men themselves tell what misdeed they found when I stood before the council. Other than for this one statement, which I shouted out while standing among them, for the resurrection of the dead, I am on trial before you today." My, oh my, how it comes full circle. Has Paul said anything illegal in that statement? But did it cause a riot? It most certainly did. So we'll continue this. Again, another cliffhanger. Paul's in the middle of his defense here before Felix, and we'll see what Felix's response to this is next week. We have 2 minutes and I need to put the slides together, so I'm going to end this early today.